Wherever you live, whatever you look like, Buckeyes from all backgrounds know bullshit when we see it. And when J.D. Vance, Bernie Moreno, and MAGA peddle it, they're trying to turn us against our neighbors while they take away our freedoms. So we say, oh, no, you don't spread hate in our state. We're voting for Sherrod Brown and leaders who care about us more than themselves.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
In the heart of these animated wonders, there are tales and symbols older and darker than the castle's highest tower. Welcome to Occult Disney. Journey with Paranoid American and Matthew Comegys as they traverse the intricate pathways of alchemy, the shadowed corners of biblical narratives, and the very folklore that birthed these tales. Beneath every brushstroke lie whispers of writers' taboos, the cloak and dagger politics of hallowed studios, and secrets held close. Every magic has its price, every kingdom its shadows. Are you prepared to peer beyond the veil? Welcome to the Occult Disney Podcast.
Here we are. It's Occult Disney. I feel like I have to say something else because the new theme music says welcome. So I'm just like, here we are. It's Matt here. It's a Paranoid American there. What's up?
What's up?
Today's movie, we're right smack in the middle of the Disney Renaissance, maybe peak hubris, possibly, with the movie Aladdin. This is one I've seen quite a bit, as opposed to last one, Beauty and the Beast, where that was my first viewing. Aladdin was, I guess, on the regs for me in the 90s, you know, clamshell video, all that sort of stuff. What's your Aladdin history?
Well, hold on. You said peak hubris. I just want to know, can you elaborate on why this movie is peak hubris?
Because it made them all the money in the world. And Jeffrey Katzenberg, this is when Katzenberg is still kind of like in the driver's seat of these. And after Lion King, you see he's going to get, you know, kind of bitch slapped, so to speak, and end up at DreamWorks. So, but I guess I'm also thinking about the theme parks. I mean, you know, early 90s for the theme parks, too, was like the time in the sun for Disney. They're opening all these giant rides, as opposed to the early 2000s, where the best they have is that, you know, California Adventure and that terrible Aladdin ride at Disney World. So
we're going to get into that. And don't you start talking about Disney Quest.
Oh, not Disney Quest. That one's fun. I got a headache from that. No, I'm talking about one where they put in Adventureland, which is like Dumbo with flying carpets, but it doesn't fit.
Oh, yeah. No, that one sucks. Yeah, we all hate that. Everybody
hates
that.
Yeah. No, I'm on page Disney Quest. That was great.
All right, we'll get into that. So you asked like what I thought, and this is a weird one for me because I guess you're talking about how like the 90s was also golden era for some of the theme parks. It's really hard for me to determine what I actually like and what's just been programmed into me to like. So like there's an example in this movie in particular when they do the whole New World song. I can't legitimately tell if that song has merit and it's like a really good, amazing song, or if I've just heard it so many times as a kid when I was like pumped up on soda and just like loving life. You know what I mean? Like I didn't have a job or homework. And I'm just hearing this song, maybe like that me tapping into the song makes me like it more in this, you know, NLP anchoring way. So I don't know. It's so long story way of saying that, like, I love this movie. I wasn't expecting to love it as much. I even liked all the songs and I hate musicals. So I was the whole time wondering like, God, am I just tapping into some like programming, you know, module that I haven't tapped into since the 90s?
I guess I was a little older and I was, you know, what, 14 or something, schmaltzed away by A Whole New World. I do like most of the other songs and I do like that one, but I had that one deprogrammed from me about 15 years ago in Japan at karaoke. The school I worked at, we had adult students and we were all together and this one kind of geeky salary man wanted to duet A Whole New World. He was already kind of drunk and every woman in the karaoke box was like, no. So he ends up duetting with another geeky salary man and they're like singing it to each other as hard as they can while really drunk. And I'm like, well, that's the definitive version of the song now. Yeah. you know, there's like they're singing so hard that you're starting to get curry breath in the room, you know. It's
that sounds like a real thing, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, what, curry breath? Yeah, that's a real thing.
You know, that like pizza. Two guys could be going at it so hard in a karaoke that like everybody smells their breath.
Yeah, that's what was happening. So now whenever I hear A Whole New World, my brain flashbacks to that karaoke box, which...
Do you smell curry when you hear it now?
A little bit. Pizza, maybe, I mean, curry pizza. It's got some cheese.
All jokes aside here, man, maybe there's something to that song in particular that like opens you up to programming to tap into. Maybe the specific sequence of notes, like the music theory behind it, maybe there's like something that they tapped into with that particular song. And again, I don't know if this is just like nostalgia, but like there's nothing else about the song that I like. I don't like any other music that sounds quite like that. Actually, there was one that I had to look up. So shout out to a very dated sounding song here, but Aladdin Arabian Nights dubstep mix by named Bloke, I guess. But if you go on YouTube and search for Aladdin Arabian Nights dubstep Bloke, it's like one of it is the definitive version of the Arabian Nights song, in my opinion.
Although maybe you've heard the recent thing, speaking about weird musical programming. Have you heard about the Taylor Swift concert phenomenon?
Where people pass out or they black out and can't remember like the last days.
Can't remember it at all. I feel like maybe that's what me and Aladdin, because I was like, when did I first see it? It's like, probably saw in the theater, but I don't have a memory of doing that. Did I see it on video first? I have like no memory of first seeing this whatsoever.
I got an even deeper one for you without getting on too much of a tangent.
Go for it.
Let's like think about your oldest memory, you know, or whatever one that is the clearest, right?
Yeah.
You don't even have to tell me what it is. Now that memory, are you sure that what you're remembering is the real event that originally happened, or are you just remembering the last time you remembered it?
Oh, that's a good point. My first memory, I'll describe it. It's not anything particularly weird, but I'm not even sure it's real. It might be from a dream. I just remember being in my parents taking me to like some townhouse or something to visit someone and being in a kind of large, not large, but you know, double story room with like a spiral staircase. I'm like, is that real? Because that itself seems to have like interesting imagery, you know.
But like even when you think about it, it's like I just guess I'm always assuming that at a certain point you've kind of through the, you know, Theseus ship, you've kind of like replaced all the elements over time. Like the first time you thought back to it, it was really crisp and clear, but every other time you think back to it, you're just thinking back to the last time you thought about it, and you're never ever actually tapping into the original memory. That might not be how it works, you know what I mean? Maybe you're actually hitting the same neuron, it's showing you the same image and it changes, but it's almost like a game of telephone you play with yourself.
See, interesting. I feel like the karaoke box memory I just described to you is more like that, where what I'm remembering is probably completely different. I mean, what, you know, the basic events I told you, but the imagery and stuff is probably completely fabricated at this point. The spiral staircase, I feel like, is pretty consistent.
Were there people in cloaks by any chance?
What, with spiral staircase? No, unfortunately, yeah. Not. There was like 70s fake plants or something, I think. So, you know, it's like 70s, you know, 70s design at its best, that sort of thing. But again,
it's coming back.
I'm not even sure if that's a real, maybe I just added the plants, so who knows? Just thinking about that sort of thing. Do you remember first seeing this one? Like I said, I'm having like kind of Taylor.
No, I'm similar to you, where I know I've seen it a million times because I've heard it. And this was another song too that they pumped in Disney Park. So when I was there at like outside of the studio, like I was hearing this thing probably every single day. You know what I mean? I can't think of. I mean, I was born in '83, so I would have been like 10 years old, I guess, when this came out. Maybe 11 or something. So I guess I was right at the very tail end of caring about this movie, but it was still something that clearly would be on if like my friend's little sister was around or something. You know what I mean? Like this was the movie, like you said, this kind of put him back on the map. Although I really do think, and man, they even had a decent like Genesis game. I know it was really hard, and I know a lot of people complain about all of the Disney video games, but the Aladdin game in particular was kind of fire. It was like really hard, but it was like, I remember the graphics at the time being amazing. Like we were all amazed that it was like, this looks like a real car. I mean, it doesn't now in retrospect, But at the time, it looked like a real freaking Disney cartoon that you got to play.
Well, they had the benefit of the PC. Prince of Persia is kind of a template, I think, if you ever saw that one. That was always the demo game at electronic stores and stuff in the early 90s.
A little bit, yeah. Although that one's got an interesting story, too, where the guy actually rotoscoped himself doing all of those moves, like the jumps and like the using the sword and falling and dying in the pits. That was all the developer, and he like scanned himself in and then like, you know, pixeled himself out. But it was an interesting tidbit. It was like before Mortal Kombat even, right? But that was like one of the first examples of a fully rotoscoped, realistic looking video game character. Prince of Persia.
Yeah.
So that comes with a trivia night. You're welcome.
All right. I'm not necessarily saying that the Aladdin Genesis game was ripping that off. Probably inspired by, but there is the, I guess there's a little more of a controversy with this movie, and I'm racking my brain for the guy's name. Maybe you can help me out. The guy that was animating an Aladdin type film for years. I think he directed The Great Mouse Detective, and,
no, this is new to me.
Okay, hold on. You got to find his name with a little search here. I'm be the man in the chair for a minute. Yeah.
And there's also an original opening to this movie and a censored version. And I'm almost positive that I saw the censored version because I remember the original song being way more offensive when I went back and watched it like years ago. And the one that I saw recently didn't have any of that. So maybe I'm just like more calloused as a person now and nothing offended me or I saw the edited version.
Yeah, there was definitely another version. I'm wondering if you saw that as a cutscene somewhere, because I feel like that didn't make it to actual
maybe it
production.
Never made it out of the theatrical release.
Right, right. Or even if it, you know, didn't quite make it to that. Gettysburg.
Okay, yeah. So this is according to LA Times, but that Disney altered two lines of the lyrics that were reported as racist. So,
oh.
Did you find your name?
I did not, unfortunately. So maybe I'll just get back to you at whatever point I do find it.
So it's this is the original lyrics. I come from a land from a faraway place where the caravan camels roam. Where they'll cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home. So that was
it's a little funky, isn't it?
And here's where they changed it to. I come from a land from a faraway place where the caravan camels roam, where it's flat and immense and the heat is intense. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, well, I know Eisner in particular was like definitely on the fence about wanting to do a Middle Eastern film, which I guess in the early 90s sounds a little weird. I'm not sure.
Also, the original story took place in China. It didn't even take place in the Middle East. I think that they just did that because its relation to the, you know, Arabian Tales, Arabian Nights, it was just more easily recognizable if you said Arabian Nights and they made this take place in, you know, Arabia, essentially, that there wouldn't be any confusion.
Yeah, it can be a little confusing. I don't have the name, but there was a movie in production for like 30 years and came out a little bit after Aladdin, but had been in various states of production forever, which was, you've probably heard of the thief and the cobbler.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And he had worked for Disney, and I still haven't like actually got a spotted his name as I'm, you know, kind of half talking, half looking. But yeah, it was started, you know, this is a British animator, I believe, who started working on this in the 60s and had done some work with Disney. So
well, sounds like Richard Williams.
Or there we go. Yes.
His name's all over this thing.
Yeah, that's got to be it. And that, you know, that was his baby. And I don't think he ever like tried to like sue Disney or anything. I think he might have just sad sacked it and finished his movie kind of slapdashed or had it taken away from him at the end. It did come out, but it actually, the final product kind of looks like an Aladdin ripoff, ironically. So
yeah. And man, I mean, just reading over like the general stats and info for this, it sounds like one of those projects that was kind of a little bit doomed, unless it was like a very polarizing project. It was either going to be amazing and smash everything, or be, you know, a little bit less than that, because it's got directed by, written by, produced by, production company featuring. It was all Richard Williams. So this was like 100% his baby. And it also has a note here in the wiki article that says The Thief and Cobbler is one of the films with the longest production times in history.
Right. So it was, and it was the tortoise and the hare thing, I guess, you know.
And it was the final film for so many people because I guess they probably worked on it when they were already old, you know, early on in production. And then the movie just like kept going on for another 30 years. And a lot of those people died, but it ended up being the last thing that they were in. It was Errol LaCaine, Ken Harris, Emery Hawkins, and it even lists Vincent Price. So this was the last movie that Vincent Price was technically in.
Right. Right. But when did he do it? Yeah. Cause Edward Scissorhands is 91, I guess. So yeah, I haven't seen this, but speaking of other guys that wanted to write, direct and produce, I was looking at something not long ago where Orson Welles' final film technically came out in like 2016 or 2017, which is kind of mind blowing, and had the same thing where it now is like the last appearance of many different people who have been, you know, dead since the '70s. So
that could be a new gimmick, right? You start a movie early on, get a bunch of actors that are like about to retire, and then don't release it for 30 years. I guess that it might go away now, right? Because Hollywood just scans your likeness and now they own your AI persona indefinitely.
Yeah, I was about to say what you're describing is better than the AI debacle, I guess.
It is, right? Yeah, you're just going to see Harrison Ford in movies for the rest of your life, no matter what.
Yeah, I know they just ended that strike, but I don't know what the final AI compromise was. So
the compromise is that China's not going to put any limits on what they do with AI and actors, so all we can do is say we're either going to like take a few rounds out or we're going to keep going and be at the forefront. That's really the only options. It's not like everyone's going to look around and be like, hey guys, the American industry has decided to hit pause, let's all hit pause, you know, like we want this to be an evil, like a level playing field. So
in a creative production though, does it matter? You know, kind of the quantity over quantity thing. If you're just going, you know, full bore with AI stuff, you can just make content, never stop. But it's, you know, probably, at least at this point, it's not the best stuff.
at this point, but let's talk again in a year, in another year from that. I think it's going to get wild, man. I think that there might be a certain point soon when you can just say my favorite movies are Aladdin and Robin Hood, mix them together and show it to me. And here's my favorite voice actors from all the Disney, you know, like have them be the voices for whatever characters you come up with. Okay, go.
Killer and it might
say, you know, come back tomorrow and this will be done or something. And it'll all just be automated. Like, I don't know if we're quite at real time. I've seen some cool real time stuff, but maybe in a year or two, like you'll just have Netflix AI version where you just hit play. You don't even pick a channel. Right. And you just kind of like, what are those old school where you would like sit down in front of like a TV show and they'd give you like a little box, right? I can't remember the guy's name, and you would like twist the dial, like when you were happy, you'd twist it to the right. And when you were getting bored or offended, you'd twist it to the left. And they would real time figure out like the key moments in a certain show when people were like twisting that dial up and down. But I mean, it was just giving a real time feedback. So now with the technology we've got, it could probably figure out from your facial expression, from your web camera, like, oh, I'm losing your interest here. Let me flash this in front of you. You know, here's a They Live scene for me, right? Here's a They Live fight scene. All of a sudden, you've got my attention again, right?
10 minutes of punching.
Yeah, just lots of punching. Just 15 minutes of punching. I mean, that would get my attention, actually.
I like how in that movie, though, they also get tired, like, in the middle and take, like, a 30-second break and then get back to the punching. That's fantastic. All about a pair of sunglasses, which, I mean, I guess you and I understand.
But put them on. Just put them on. Hey, and by the way, in case that sounds like a complete tangent that we're talking about They Live in an Aladdin show, there is a direct connection back here because they cite one of the best quotes of all time that is in They Live. And it's in a few other movies that I've seen recently. I think the movie Society, which is a really crazy movie by the guy that did a Reanimator. Anyways, the quote is, everybody remember the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And I've noticed, like, synchronicity wise, that specific quote comes up in a lot of weird and strange movies. And Aladdin.
Okay, yeah, I was sitting here thinking, I'm pretty sure that he didn't say anything about chewing bubblegum and kicking ass in Aladdin. So, but yeah, there's a lot of
again, Netflix sure. AI edition, right? Show me They Live in Aladdin. Go. I think that would be cool. I know that, you know, some people aren't as excited. I wouldn't say excitement, but I just think that's it's happening anyways. You might as well enjoy the final days.
Yeah, I know 6 months ago there was that thing where people were making all the fake commercials, and within three, I noticed that all of them ended with people melting and exploding, and then the world ends. That's like how all of them ended, which I'm like, well, it's 6 months later. I imagine we're getting something different by now.
But maybe we're already dead.
Yeah, yeah, maybe we're all on a holodeck already. We are all, well, that's basically Gnostic theory, isn't it? Philosophy, I should say.
So I'm gonna want to make a note to actually watch the Thief and the Cobbler, because it sounds like that's got a lot of occult references within it. But we'll add that to the end of the list. We've got so many more to go through.
Yeah, and that one just has the problem where it sputtered at the end. Like, apparently there's like 15 minutes of amazing footage, and then the rest of it they kind of had to throw together. So you unfortunately get a bit of a mixed bag on that one. Beauty and the Beast, I was talking about how Belle was a relatively empowered lady stuck in a bad situation, where it seems we've taken a bit of a step back with Jasmine, though. Which could be because we have different
directors. Was Belle empowered, though? Because... Well,
she was at least sharper. Let's say that.
Maybe. I don't know, man. I mean, I think that she's just as dumb and perhaps less empowered, because this Jasmine can escape from her castle and go out as, you know, a normie, and then go back to her castle at night where she's safe and rich again. And that feels way more powerful than... You know, you're going to go and live with this beast and you're forced to be here and you're not allowed to leave. Like, her agency is literally removed from her. And the only way that she can get out of her situation is by being really nice to, you know, this old grumpy man in reality.
Yeah, I guess I was feeling more of a reversion plot, where now it's like, you have to get married tomorrow, you know.
That, and well, there's also this one, just like Beauty and the Beast, is a really good example of the golden bough and the old, you know, matriarchy, where you marry the princess in order to take over the kingdom. So that, because in a lot of other, like in Cinderella, for example, it's like she's seeking after this prince to, you know, marry into wealth and to rise her up from this lower class status that she's got. And then this one, it's the truer version of that, the inversion, where you've got Aladdin, who's a thief. He's a literal, you know, he's a criminal essentially in this society. And he changes and transforms himself into a completely different person in order to win over the princess. And then, even though in the movie it's all about, you know, they love each other and it's true love, and he just happens to be a really poor con man, but this is real love. I mean, this is definitely true love. And it just happens to be that she's the princess, and that everything here comes with power. So, and you even see that when he initially gets turned into the prince, he immediately goes to his head, right? Like, he's already trying to like call shots and doesn't want to tell her that he's a prince. And because like he wants to portray this lifestyle that he sees himself in. So I don't know. I feel like that aspect of it, I don't know. It's like the biggest dynamic of it, and how it kind of like plays into the golden bough theory and like fits into the puzzle perfectly.
It's like Jafar's living his truth more. You know, he knows what he wants. He almost gets it. Aladdin gumps in backwards into it, you know?
So Jafar, you're absolutely right. Jafar understands the golden bough. I almost think like Aladdin's like the fool in the tarot, right? Like, he's like bumbling into this world, but he also... Like, he's the criminal, he's the con man. Jafar's also a criminal and a con man, but he's doing the revelation of the method. He's almost like telling you up front that he's being bad, and you also realize as the viewer, like, oh, he's bad because he's letting you know overtly he's also going to kill the king. Like, not only is he going to marry Jasmine and inherit the kingdom, but he's going to kill the king to make this happen. But that is the actual real matriarchal story, is that you didn't just marry the princess and then sit around as a lame duck waiting for dad to croak. Like, that was part of it. You would win her hand and you would kill her dad so that you become the new dad. And it, this is like the king kill ritual we've brought up a few times. Like, this is that thing, right? Because you don't want to let dad get old and wither away, because that means the kingdom that you're about to inherit is also old and withering. So you kind of need it like vibrant. You need to make a big scene.
And let's put it out there. Jafar is not a liar. Aladdin is.
That is true. Well, maybe.
Yeah, he's deceitful. He's got his hypnosis and stuff.
I'm
pushing with a broad brush there, but I just, yeah.
That's an interesting thought, though.
He's more upfront about what he wants to do.
Is hypnotizing somebody a lie?
Or a method. I don't know.
Is it even deception? Is hypnotizing somebody deception?
I'm just trying to be wacky. Nobody likes Jafar. I was going for that thing where he decided Mary Poppins is evil. Oh no, Jafar is a real hero. No, I'm not really going to take on that, but I thought I'd play that bit.
You're going to die on that hill, the yeah. Jafar hill.
No, I'm not really going to go down the Jafar hill, but I don't know. I guess we should think a little bit about the Robin Williams hill. That would have been my hook in 1993. I think I saw it in the theater, but that's when people wanted to see movies that Robin Williams was in. And, you know, although I didn't see Miss Doubtfire, weirdly enough, but
ever.
I think I saw it once on video, like at a spring break or something, but it's not
a bad movie. It's not a bad movie.
It's not one that's in my consciousness. But when I was a very little kid, Mork and Mindy was on TV. So I like that. I like Robin Williams then. And he's in movies. I like him then. I only recently started listening to his comedy. I'd been listening to the same 10 comedy albums in the car. So I finally put some new ones on my phone, including a couple of his. So,
man, there was an old stand-up that I remember seeing on TV when I was a little kid in like the very early 90s, maybe late 80s. And it was Robin Williams, and he's got these rainbow suspenders on, and he's bouncing off the walls, dripping with sweat. And there's even someone in the audience that's like heckling him by laughing really annoying. And he heckles them back at one point. I wish I could remember the exact whatever this video special was that he did, but man, it was wild. Like he did all the cocaine that night, like in the whole world probably.
Yes. The ones I had in the car was Night of the Met, which I think was right after he stopped doing cocaine, and then his last one, which was Weapons of Mass Dysfunction or something. I think I got the name a little bit wrong there, but that was surprisingly funny. Yeah. So I know I was bummed out when he went out in whatever method that entailed. The official line at this point is he didn't have Parkinson's, but he had something related to Parkinson's, which apparently does make you like get demented and suicidal. So who knows? But at the same time,
did he know too much? He was friends with Patch Adams, and Patch Adams was in The Finders or adjacent to The Finders. Just throwing that out there. Now, that's not according to me. That's according to, I think, Ken Thomas from Steam Shovel Press. It's in his book called Paranoia something or other. Anyways,
it's like in Robin Williams, because here's the thing, I would probably say yes, he had this disease, got a little weird in the head and probably did it, but I want to believe that was a conspiracy because I like him. I want to think that no, the bad guys took him out.
Is Robin Williams but we're getting weird in the head? What version of Robin Williams is that one?
There was Tim and Eric, awesome show, great job, where they had like a, yes, it was that show. They have an episode where they rent a Robin Williams. Like they just have some guy come to their office that's doing a Robin Williams impression, doing impressions of everyone else. And it's very meta and entertaining. But I guess the genie is one of his iconic roles now. Definitely one of the first iconic roles for an animated character, I would say. Can you think of anyone before this where it was like, yes, this actor and this animated character are just completely interlinked?
Not on the spot, no. So I mean, this would be one of the biggest ones,
and one of the biggest stars to do an animated film at this point.
Also. Yeah, this would have been a draw. Like having Robin Williams' name on this would have been a draw at this point for sure.
Again, for 14-year-old Matt, that was part of the draw. I guess I should mention that the design for him and Jafar is also based on Al Hirschfeld designs, which is kind of cool. Who did what? Saturday Evening Post, I believe. I can actually look at that. He just did Celebrity and Broadway Stars, but I like that style. So, you know, kind of a Art Deco-ish style.
And on the tail of that question too, like what other animated sort of character has this much personality like Link? Like what other Disney sidekick would you want more than a Pooh?
Well, I want the monkey version. I don't want the elephant version.
Well, yeah, yeah. We're talking about the monkey version of a Pooh. But I just remember when this movie came out, a Pooh, like all of a sudden shot to the top of my like celebrity pet list. And I guess like there's only a few of them on there, but a Pooh was definitely at the top of those. I think the other one would have been Gizmo from Gremlins. I think he was at the top of my, I wish I had.
I had a stuffed Gizmo. I mean, I was a weird kid. I had like a netting of like stuffed animals like through surprisingly late in my childhood. But
but if you could actually pick one that was real, which one would it be? Would it be Gizmo?
Oh, for my own sidekick, like my new pet.
Yeah, and not for like as an ad, like an advantage. Like we're talking, you know, I don't know, 10-year-old Matt. Like what sidekick does 10-year-old Matt want to come to life?
See, now I'm like, oh, it's Stitch, but Stitch wasn't around yet, so the 10-year-old Matt wouldn't like Stitch. Mm-hmm. I think I want the X-Men to be real.
I don't know if you can have Wolverine as a pet, though. I don't know if that makes the same amount of sense.
I think I said before, when I was a kid, I just assumed, you know, someday, like, I just start shooting laser beams out of my eyes, you know? I guess that's better than worrying about puberty. You worry about the laser beams that are going to shoot out of your eyes. We're almost there. Yeah.
You have to pay big for that one, though.
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
But yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of modern films. One of the best, I think it's the movie Epic, where they got Steven Tyler to voice a character. And I wish I could remember that guy's name. But it's like, it doesn't matter Steven Tyler's doing the voice because his speaking voice, like, doesn't matter.
That's true. Yeah. You want to hear him say, yeah, he should have done Flintstones and just said Yabba Dabba Doo the whole time. It would have been great.
Yeah, I think it was Nim Galoob, maybe was the name of his character, if I remember correctly. It's a very bizarre name. So it's hard to search that because the movie title is so generic. But Aladdin you can find. I'm also looking for who... So Robin Williams, he agreed to do this. He said, you can't use my voice in advertising, which I guess you couldn't get away with that now. And he didn't come back for the direct-to-video sequel. But right. He came back for the third one. I guess they drove like a dump truck of money to his house or something, or blackmailed him. Who knows?
Yeah, like do this or else it's going to look like you offed yourself. Yeah, and then they came back to him with Aladdin 4 and he was like, I'm not doing it. And they were like, all right.
who does it? And let's see. Gilbert Godfrey's still there. Oh, it's actually just some guy. Okay, it's not anyone notable in the sequel. That's too bad.
And I had completely forgot that Gilbert Gottfried was in this as the parrot. That was a nice surprise, just hearing his voice out of nowhere.
Yeah, he's the most fun villain sidekick, though they should not have added him to the Tiki Room, as they did for a while.
Maybe. I kind of like the Gia monster from Rescuers Down Under as the sidekick. I can't remember the thing's name.
See, we watched it last
It was like month. A girl's name. It was like Clarissa or something. It wasn't that, but it was something.
I guess it doesn't stick in the brain for me quite as much. I mean, Iago, you remember that name, right? Shakespeare and all. And Gilbert Godfrey screaming at you. You remember that, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The 90s with Abu and you know, Lion King, we get to some nice sidekicks. Disney was owning the sidekick game in the 90s. We definitely have to give them that.
Yeah. Yeah, fair point. And the Happy Meal game too. They were killing it with the Happy Meal toys. Like almost every Happy Meal toy I remember was some kind of Disney IP.
Yeah, yeah. I know we don't have a ton of time today, and we definitely have some things underground like Caves of Gold. So if we want to crack into some of your notes there.
Yeah, so I'm going to just do some rapid fire so we can kind of go back and just casually discuss some of it as it comes up naturally. The Golden Bough piece of this is the biggest one. Like, Occult Disney Podcast, the absolute biggest symbolism that you can derive from this is 100% Golden Bough. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, the Golden Bough represented this branch of a tree and that faraway, you know, traveler that would typically be from a lower class of society, a prince in his own right, but he would convert himself into this foreigner and infiltrate another kingdom and win the daughter's hand and kill the father. And killing that father is basically getting that Golden Bough off the tree. So that is by far and away, this is Aladdin movie is such a great sort of fit into that because he's got the whole, you know, criminal con man aspect. And so anyways, that is the biggest takeaway. And then there's some other like really cool things. So for example, we were mentioning,
to interrupt really quick. For listeners, yeah, the last two episodes we talked about that. Next one's The Lion King. We're gonna be talking about it again. So it's definitely the Disney Renaissance seems to be Golden Bough time. So yeah, sorry.
and it's just it's the formula. This is like, you know, when every pop song follows the same three or four chords and the same chord progression, like this is the formula that just happens to work. So And first of all, we were talking about how the original intro lyrics were changed because people found it offensive. But even in the post-censored version that I saw in the dialogue of the movie outside of the song, they still talk about rip him open. I had to slit a few throats, but I got it. There's a whole bunch of references to like someone's going to die. Like you're being threatened with death right now. Oh, and they're going to chop Jasmine's hand off when she gets caught stealing an apple. And it's like, you know what we do with thieves around here. So I don't know. It's weird that singing about chopping somebody's ear off is, you know, the bad thing, but you can say it like three different ways in dialogue. Maybe they just didn't want people singing that particular earworm. I guess I can kind of understand it, right? But it's like, it kind of goes to prove that these Disney earworms are far more powerful than just the dialogue, right? Poetry is stronger than prose when it comes to Occult Disney.
When you're talking about the sequence of notes, I was just playing them in my head. I was kind of thinking the basic motif of A Whole New World is a little bit like the alien contact notes from Close Encounters. It's a weird similarity, just talking about how it might program or something.
That's what I was saying, man. I think that there might be, and not necessarily that somebody sat down and said, I know that this chord progression and these notes at this cadence is going to tap into something deeper where people go into almost a trance-like state. But here we are, and I feel like that's what they got. So you hear A Whole New World. Maybe it's only if you also grew up in the 90s and also had it pumped into your head while you were walking around Kmart or wherever it might have been and on TV commercials. But I'm telling you that it's like a Game Genie cheat code to like slip in some extra lives or something. Maybe the next iteration of MK Ultra Assassins are going to hear Disney jingles and, you know, turn into Manchurian candidates.
I teach kids and the thing that's interesting is the Little Mermaid, Ariel and Jasmine are still what most of the little girls have on their drink bottles and t-shirts. Not so much Belle. Even Frozen is kind of tapered off a little bit, but Jasmine and Ariel just keep showing up, even with, you know,
Belle's the 4-year-old creepy, man. I'm just gonna say Belle's creepy from any vantage point you look at it from. Like even if you sort of resolve the fact that it is, you know, bestiality, right, after you even get over that aspect of it, it's still creepy. Beauty and the Bestiality.
Yeah.
that's a t-shirt in the waiting.
Crowd. Yeah.
That should be the first Occult Disney t-shirt. Just Beauty and the Bestiality.
Ouch. I guess that means it's a good idea.
so a couple other notes here. Apu is his literal like animal consciousness. That this is Aladdin's consciousness as its animal spirit before it has the human spirit attached to it. It comes out in a few different ways. For example, when they go into that underground, you know, cave and they find the treasure, Apu goes right for the gold, but Aladdin has to stop him. And it's like, no, we're not here for that. We have to keep going. He's also the one that doesn't want to give up his food to the kids in the beginning. And there's a few other instances throughout this movie where it just they're clearly showing that Apu does the things that Aladdin wants to do, but has that human consciousness that prevent him from just acting as a pure animal. Jafar doesn't have that. Jafar has the opposite. If anything, his parrot, Gilbert Gottfried, you know, has more resolve and kind of has more, I guess, like morality or guilt or whatever you want to call that than Jafar does. Whereas Aladdin and Apu, they go hand in hand as like this yin and yang.
Yeah, I feel like the non-human characters in this kind of get the shaft. I mean, the genie is under thousands of years of astral bondage.
He knew what he did.
Oh yeah. Apu gets turned into an elephant against, you know, any consideration to what Apu wants. Iago, while being annoying, like you said, is a little bit more moral, but he gets stuck in with Jafar and the lamp in the end. So, you know.
he balances Jafar out. Like, if it weren't for his parrot, Jafar would just be total evil with nothing at all to restrain him. And it's not that, like, the parrot tells him what to do, but just its mere presence is the only thing that maybe balances out a little bit. And also, just to hone on the whole Golden Bough thing again, Jasmine's dad, I can't remember his name, but he is shown as so effeminate. Like, he's basically just like a big marshmallow, you know, effeminate puff that has no gender whatsoever. He's kind of this asexual, like, marshmallow person.
Oh, you don't know his name because he's just called the Sultan.
The Sultan, yeah.
Of Swing.
He doesn't even have a name, yeah.
Oh, well, I'm looking at this Frank Welker voiced Abu, which is always fun to read when you have Frank Welker just doing animal voices.
Right, it's like George Clooney doing like the dog in South Park.
But Welker, you know, of course he did, you know, Megatron, Transformers or whatever, but most of his roles are just like, you know, like in animated movies making animal noises, like sometimes not even doing any actual voicing, like in with words. So he's the
master. I wish I could have got that job, man. That sounds like an awesome job.
Yeah, you sit there going quah, 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 all day or whatever. Yeah, it's, I don't know.
a couple other things too. There's a giveaway here about the Golden Bough that Aladdin is not just some street urchin that they kind of portray him to be, and that's because his outfit is purple and everything in the like the royal sort of guard and everything, they wear purple, and this purple color would have been still at this point sort of a symbol of royalty. It would have been really hard to get, dating all the way back to the Phoenicians and the Greeks and the Romans that made it illegal to even own the same color of purple as the royals. But you notice in this movie, Aladdin does have purple, and technically his purple is slightly darker than the royal guard has. So I don't know. It might just be the color palette that Disney decided to go with, but there's other things in this movie that fit way too much into the pieces to be coincidences.
I had a few thoughts, especially when they try to drown Aladdin and just the basic look of
Jafar. Houdini style.
Well, actually, I was thinking more about Rasputin, which I guess would make a little more sense in a royal court. how, because Jafar does seem like the Rasputin, but then they try and give Aladdin the Rasputin death, which, like, Rasputin doesn't take the first 13 times or so, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, how do you kill someone that's truly magic?
I don't know how many people saw this, but there was a History of the World Part 2 last year, a TV series, which had a several sketches of, like, it was Jackass style where they're trying to kill Rasputin. So with the Jackass music in the background and stuff is pretty funny. the best part of that whole series, if you've seen History of the World Part 1, it has the black thing with the title card and Mel Brooks is the narrator, which is, yeah. He still does this new one. That's the only thing I think he does in a new one. But at one point it just says Jesus Christ and you just hear him, Jesus Christ, in a Mel Brooks voice. And for me, that was the funniest part of the thing.
Is the new one a movie or is it a series of shows?
It's a series.
I'm almost positive I saw it, but it just kind of went in one and out the other for me.
I was just, when my folks were visiting last week, we put that on because it's offensive, but it's just like, it kind of rolls, you know?
It's like Mel Brooks offensive, which is,
yeah, everyone knows,
feels outdated offensive now.
Yeah, it's like security blanket offensive or something.
Like life alert offensive.
Anyway, that was way tangent, so let's get back on your tracks.
And I forgot to mention this one. The other favorite sidekick from when I was a kid. I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Skateboard Kid, but he has a skateboard that comes alive and talks and flies. So I always thought that was really cool, although it was kind of terrifying looking.
Oh, you know, I discounted the sidekick. Okay, here's what I wanted. I wanted that ship from Flight of the Navigator, which... Man,
oh, that movie was so boring.
But when I was seven, I loved it, and I wanted the.
Yeah, I don't know. I saw that movie when I was seven too, and I was bored to tears. Or I just remember like, where's ET at, dude?
Yeah, or explorers where they build like their garbage can ship. That's kind of cool. I wanted that kind of thing. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
That's not quite a sidekick, I guess. That's a little. That's more of an accessory. But yeah, that's what I wanted.
So yeah,
but I want a pet monkey now. I didn't want a pet monkey when I was a kid. Now I want the monkey.
Well, I had an uncle apparently that had one of those little grinder organ monkeys. I don't know if I brought that up before. And it did the thing that it bit people, so he had to stop bringing it out in public, and then he kept it inside, and then it just started like furiously, you know, pleasuring itself all over the place inside. And because it was extremely aggressive, like you couldn't. Like, good luck trying to stop an angry monkey from doing that whenever he wants to. Like, you don't get to control that part of it. You know what I mean? I don't know. Like, yeah, like trying to put your cat into a box to bring to a vet.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't want pets at all. But if I had a pet...
Well, you heard it here. Don't get an organ grinder monkey. So, I don't even know if it's like a specific type or not. But so... The Magic Rug. Let's talk about the Magic Rug first, because even if we do have to cut short, I need to talk about Disney Quest, because Disney Quest was within, you know, like that was where I went to lunch sometimes when I was working at Disney. We would go over there and, you know, hang out in what now I think is like Disney Springs, and they knocked down Disney Quest, and now it's like a chocolate
NBA
shop
Hall
or
of
something.
Fame, I think.
it's like, yeah, there's a bunch of stuff out there, but It was this very dated ride where you sat down on a little sort of like hydraulically controlled magic carpet and put on what looked like this huge, you know, like first version of VR from the late 90s. Like we're talking like a huge thing strapped in, and it looked very like Lawnmower Man-esque, you know, futuristic style. But and you mentioned what it gave you a headache, right? A lot of people got a headache from this thing because just like the original VR headsets, it didn't necessarily have the greatest refresh rate. And there's this weird concept of people consider VR sickness and getting your VR legs. And it's just that your body's not used to seeing movement, but not feeling movement. And that was basically what like 90% of this Aladdin VR ride was, is that like you're moving around a little bit, but it's not like 100% synchronized to what you're seeing. So your body feels something slightly different than what your eyes are reporting back that it should be feeling. And this makes a lot of people sick at first.
Yeah. I mean, we went to Disney Quest mostly for the, there is an insane psychedelic air hockey table and just a ton of vintage games you couldn't find anywhere else. That was our chief draw to go there. And it was 2010 or 2009, maybe. Yeah. So it's sort of right in the middle of its life.
Towards the end of its life, it really was this like relic of stepping back into the past, and not necessarily like an old arcade, although it took that role a little bit towards the end. But it was also just like, this was at one point the height of technology, right? But going back and seeing it in 2010 or a little bit after that, it was almost like, oh, isn't that funny what, you know, mom and dad thought was advanced? or even going and thinking like, man, I can't remember this was advanced. Like when like an Atari game came out and you were like, man, it looks just like the Kool-Aid Man. This is incredible. And you see it now and it's like, which one of those four black squares is his face again, you know?
Yeah, it was supposed to, you know, be franchised in cities all over the place. It's like, oh, you don't have to go.
Yep.
All the way up
no, they had one in Chicago. They had one in a bunch of places. They were trying to make it like a little miniature, like a mini mall version of a theme park where you could kind of like go there for just like half the day or something, and like an arcade meets this, but it would fit inside of like a mini mall type of area. But yeah, it didn't last forever.
Of course, then there's Philadelphia where they build a giant hole and then just left it there.
There's something cult about that.
Yeah, yeah. There's also economic downturns, I guess, for the company in particular.
quick, build a big hole. We're running out of money. Big a bigger one.
and they had what was the name of the Space Mountain one where you would design your own coaster? That had some kind of insane name.
You're putting me on the spot here. It was like 1-2-3 Blast Off or Mission to Mars, maybe.
Anyway, I remember that being fun. Oh, and Buzz Lightyear's Astro Blaster, not Blasters. This is just a bumper car ride. I remember that. That was fun.
Design your own rocket ship ride, whatever the heck it was called. That thing gave me a headache. But that was because it like bounced you around in that little freaking cubicle thing.
It's your fault. You made it. Should have made it. It
was my fault. I did make it. Because I was like, I want to see how extreme this thing can get. Well, guess what? It can give you a migraine. So that's how extreme it can get.
Yes. Yeah.
So in this movie, the genie gives rules that can't be broken, apparently.
But so not this... Jafar, who runs into them organically. But he is
right. Too much. Yeah. No. That's a very good point. So the genie mentions that his rules are: one, that he can't kill anybody; two, that he can't make anybody fall in love; and three, that he can't bring people back from the dead. But he implies that the third one, and therefore by proxy the first two, isn't because he's not able to, but it's because he's unwilling to. And he mentions that when he brought people back from the dead, it got creepy, or he didn't like doing it. So that made me think too, are these his rules that apply to him too? Like, he won't ever kill anyone and he won't ever make anyone fall in love? Or is it just that he won't let another person, wish for death or wish for love? Because immediately after this whole introduction, he basically tells him, like, you have to make these wishes. You're not allowed not to. And he plops him on the magic carpet and he zips off. But the way that he zips off, it was almost threatening. Like, I can kill you right now. Like, if I threw you off of this carpet, you would die. So therefore you have to make these wishes or else ...
Yeah, maybe. I was thinking one of the rules is not that you could wish for more wishes. That was not one of the rules. That should
it be was rule. Not. And he missed out on a great loophole there.
I think since Aladdin, I think everyone noticed that with Aladdin. So they make sure to, if you have genies and later things,
they had to button that thing up.
I don't know what they did in the live action one, 'cause I didn't watch it, but
I do. I like the idea that maybe there's even like a credit system. Like, you can wish for more wishes, but you really have a finite amount of reality that you can change. So if one of your wishes is like, I wish I had a cold drink in front of me and it pops up, that's way different than I wish, like my face was on Mount Rushmore. And like, maybe that one costs a little bit more. So you can have 100 wishes, you can have 1,000,000 wishes, but it better be a bunch of like, I wish I could remember the name of that movie that's on the tip of my tongue. And there's just a genie that's like, it was The Goodfellas. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. It was The Goodfellas.
Of course, I do the Twilight Zone podcast. So I recently watched the Twilight Zone episode where the guy wishing himself into power ends up, in Hitler's bunker as Hitler. So that was a fun episode.
That guy was a genius. Yeah, nothing but good things to say about that whole series.
Do you get through those magic carpets?
Let's see. And a tangent on that, the carpet ride and threatening and just roller coasters in general. I just want to make the note, in case it's not even abundantly obvious, but that the only reason roller coasters are fun is because you think you're going to die. And you're basically having fun with the idea that you are great, like your consciousness is smarter than your biology. So just like in that, the VR, Disney Quest thing where you get sick and your eye sees one thing and your body's feeling another one. Well, now here's a different version where your body is feeling one thing and it's telling everything else, like, you're going to die. What are you doing? You're about to die. Find cover, stop what you're doing. But you've got no control because you're usually like falling or getting whipped around and you're strapped in and you're, kind of isolated and trapped in this little thing. And it's the same thing why people like to drive fast. The only reason that it's fun to drive fast is because your body's telling you you're about to die. And the ability to suppress that for a while can be very, very sort of like energetic. And, it gives this like feeling of elation. But it's also why it only lasts for certain bursts of time. Like, I wonder how long your body can truly feel like it's about to die and it remain fun. And there's like a reason why a lot of Disney rides, even the roller coaster ones, like 90 seconds max a lot of the time.
Sorry, that just made me think of the ridiculous movie Clifford, where Martin Short's Clifford was so annoying that
the skit with the Larry the scary Rex. He's a scary dinosaur. Don't be scared of his sharp teeth or his mighty roar.
Three times, he just keeps him on the ride. But Clifford's such an idiot; he just loves it.
I always want, dude. That's another. I don't know if I want to say sidekick. If Clifford, I wanted him to be my sidekick, but. Like, I wanted to live in his shoes so bad. Like, and I knew it wasn't a kid, but, you know.
I was just found out recently that the movie Benjamin Button, of course, came out in 2008. But around that time, Martin Short was attached to a Benjamin Button project. So maybe happened. I mean, it's going to be like a comedy at that point in time.
I want to live in that reality. I want to get out of this reality and live in that. I don't care if the world ended like a year afterwards. Like, put me in that reality.
You want Martin Short's Benjamin Button. So at that perfect moment where you get Brad Pitt in the 2008, you'd get Jimmy Glick for the Martin Short version.
Can I just say, there's a movie with Brad Pitt called Meet Joe Black. And there's this freaking scene where, spoiler alert, but he's just like, it's like a normal movie and he's walking. And then all of a sudden a car just comes by and just like pummels him. And in that moment, I was so unexpecting it. I just burst out laughing and I don't know what that was. And actually speaking of Robin Williams, remember the movie Insomniac where he plays like some creepy teacher or something. And he like brings this girl back to his secluded house in Alaska. I'm getting some of these mixed up a little bit, but he as he's driving her back to his house, he looks at her and he like either tries to kiss her or he says that he wants it, like he does something, makes a move on her, and she laughs at him and he gets so offended and like surprised by her laughing that he just punches her in the face and like knocks her out. And that I saw in the movie theater, and for whatever weird, very weird reason, I just burst out laughing and looked like an absolute maniac for laughing that, you know, Robin Williams just punched somebody in the face in a non-funny movie. But anyways, like that particular moment, it just like, I don't know, it does something to me.
I know I mentioned on podcast before, I don't know this one, but we're having a family Sunday viewing of The Shining when Scatman Brothers takes it. My wife shrieks in terror, and my daughter starts howling in laughter, like simultaneously. So
we call it the Aristocats.
So that was kind of that was the most fun movie reaction I've seen. Of course, I'd seen it; I knew what's happening, but I got to get two completely different first time reactions.
I've got one other final note here before I wrap mine up. That in the lyrics towards the end, they say, genuflect, show some respect, down on one knee, make a deal, third wish, set the genie free. And I can't hear the word genuflect without thinking about Tracy Twyman, who wrote the book Genuflect.
I haven't read that book. I do remember that story from, or that debacle, or that tragedy from a few years ago, whatever, but
There was one other one too. I just can't remember what the heck it was. I even had screenshots of it, but there was I'm gonna have to paraphrase it, but Aladdin says something about get in the square and like peer through the veil. And the way that he says it in the sequence, it felt so Masonic about like step on the square and like take off your veil. But anyways,
this is Ashman had died by the time this was in production. I think three of his songs end up in here, and the other four are Tim Rice, who's going to be the big lyricist from here on out. So I wonder if you were to separate the songs they wrote, you know, maybe you could see a little bit more relief and like what they were pushing forward, because we got two different people here, you know, who might have things in it, trying to put little Easter eggs in of whatever kind.
And speaking of Easter eggs, this is the movie that's supposed to have all good teenagers take off your clothes quote. Although I think it's dubious. Like, I want that to be the real story, but I don't really think that that's what happened. It was like another story where he's talking to Rafir or something, and it just kind of came out like that because of an overdubbing issue.
But I mean, that's the one thing doing this podcast. Like, in The Lion King, we're going to have where they supposedly kick sex in the air. We had the obvious phalluses in The Little Mermaid, but the more interesting thing is, wow, all of these recent movies we've done have the Golden Bough. That's again,
that's more, dude. And that, to me, that's way more fascinating. And the premise of Beauty and the Beast is way more damaging ever in a million years than a kid maybe seeing the letters S-E-X. Come on, like, he's going to see that word a million times in school, you know, on like the pages. So I don't know. That feels less threatening, and the Golden Bough maybe more so.
Japanese elementary school boys will invariably decide the number 6 sounds like sex and then just start saying it a lot in class. So, you know, it's like,
I remember like, I don't know, second grade, maybe third grade, and like finding the S word in the dictionary, and it was like the coolest thing ever, you know, like, wow, this book has a bad word in it.
pre-internet days. I know we got to wrap this one up, so if you want to talk about your goings-ons of now.
Yeah, actually, right now, ChaosTwins.com is a comic series that I'm putting out with Sam Tripoli. It's already blown past all of its goals on Indiegogo. You can go to ChaosTwins.com and look at it. Even if you're listening to this in the far, far future, ChaosTwins.com should bring you to wherever you can get a copy of it. And it's about Bigfoot and Mothman and cryptids and interdimensional reptilians and what we talk about on this show, which is weaponizing nostalgia, all that wrapped up in a family-friendly, kid-friendly comic book series, which might sound weird compared to anything else you've ever seen me put out. But it's, you know, it's a new avenue and it's doing really freaking well. So that's my biggest project right now, ChaosTwins.com.
Okay. My podcasting world, I do a few others where we were kind of strike supporting by doing some off the Hollywood stuff recently, but now it's kind of exciting that we get to get back to our normal things on Time Enough Podcast of doing Twilight Zone episodes. So dig that. There is Films and Filth, where we are looking at the top 100 and bottom 100 films as rated by IMDb, which is going to put me in the weird position of, I think I'm going to end up, we're going to do our Toy Story episode, and I'll be doing that Toy Story episode at about the same time. So, but for different points of view. So yeah,
maybe we should all just get together and do like a super show where we just mix both themes together.
I would almost say that, but my co-host has invited his girlfriend as the guest, so I feel like I have
to let her in. I'll invite mine too. We'll just have a big party.
Yeah, sure. Okay, I'm gonna ride my magic carpet. I wish I want that more than the Navigator ship now. Magic carpet. Yeah, why not?
Kinda. I don't know. There's something.
You fall off, I guess, if you're height.
Yeah, yeah, there's just something that's not very. I don't know. Is this like my machismo speaking? But I don't know. I need something cooler than a flying carpet.
Well, you make it cool. You get a costume. You're like, yeah, you know, you make it cool. You put some cool drapes.
How about a flying tank? How about a flying tank?
Okay, I'll go to work in my flying tank today and see what happens. Do some donuts in the parking lot.
Ohio seniors, make the right call for better Medicare benefits with Medical Mutual. Call 1-866-966-9338 to find a plan today. Enroll by December 7th.
Wherever you live, whatever you look like, Buckeyes from all backgrounds know bullshit when we see it. And when J.D. Vance, Bernie Moreno, and MAGA peddle it, they're trying to turn us against our neighbors while they take away our freedoms. So we say, oh, no, you don't spread hate in our state. We're voting for Sherrod Brown and leaders who care about us more than themselves.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.